books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show we'll hear about the career of Alistair Lee, Australia's only blind voiceover artist. Plus, as he goes on tour, we'll listen back to the great pottery throwdown judge Keith Brimmer-Jones talk about his book Boy in a China Shop. All that and more on today's Read On.
Alistair Lee is Australia's only blind voice actor, although he could easily fool you into thinking he's from the English countryside, from North America's deep south, or a train announcer in Paris. He's recorded for so many big names, from Mercedes-Benz to the Human Rights Commission to the Great British Bake Off and many more, and he's here today to tell us more about his work. Before we start our chat, let's listen to what Alistair can do.
Seamus, you need to understand now that you've really upset a lot of people. They're not happy about what you've done.
I spoke to David about it. He said he couldn't quite read the document in front of him, but he'll be back in about half an hour, all right?
Please sit down, Comrade Colonel. I must warn you that this is only the beginning of your interrogation.
Darling, really? The florist isn't open until about 9 o'clock. Can you go and organise that?
Hi, Alistair. Can you tell us about how you first got into voice acting?
Well, I had a bit of an interesting journey into voice acting. I was born blind. I've got no sight at all, so I've always been blind and never had any vision at all. And so growing up, I listened to a lot of audiobooks on tape. And some of your listeners, if they're as old as I am, would probably remember the Pickwick Teletales and Ladybird books. And they were done in the 70s and the 80s. My mother, who's English, and I used to spend a lot of time in England, would go and buy me lots of these. So I had this wonderful repository of voices to listen to. And they were extraordinary with classical music. The productions were fantastic. They had all the sound effects. And so from a very young age, I would always enjoy mimicking and listening and wondering how these people would do these extraordinary voices. And I travelled to England a lot as a child. And so one of my favourite things was to go to the Royal Show. And I would just walk around it and have my ears out on stalks listening. There'll be £500 over that side. Oh dear, what's going on with that one? I don't like that. It's too expensive. Well, we can try again later. And so that sort of allowed me to build up this wonderful library of in my head of all these different voices and sounds. I was quite musical as well. I played professionally as a jazz player and so went off, did school as one does. And then someone suggested, a friend of the family's, that I do a voice course with an amazing woman based in Sydney called Julia Jordan, who runs a company called The Voice Business. And she's got a wonderful transatlantic accent. It's sort of half American, half English. And she trained me originally in how the voice industry actually works and what it is. And another great friend of mine, who's sadly no longer with us, was Australia's first blind voiceover artist by the name of Matt Ponsonby. And he mentored me. He was, you know, almost like a second dad. And he always said to me from a young age, this is something you should do because you've got the skills and the ears. And so I went off to one of the top agents in the country when I was very, very young and was given some wonderful advice by their managing director, who said to me, look, you know, we think you've done an amazing first demo. Go to uni, learn a little bit about life, and then come back and we'll be ready for you. And it was a wonderfully gentle and generous comment, because I had a few other life challenges at that stage, so I probably wasn't really ready to launch into the voice world as such at that point. So I went off to university, studied, then went into IT. I ran IT for a national company, and then started doing voiceovers on the side with that agency about 20 years ago as sort of a part-time thing, and eventually built it into a full-time career, which is one of the most wonderful things to be able to do.
When did you feel ready to return to the world of voice acting?
I've had a very diverse life experience. I think it allowed me the confidence to suddenly go, this is really what I want to do as a full-time job. Voiceovers now, the industry is changing quite a lot, both here and overseas, and it's becoming much, much harder to get into. You've really got to have either quite a unique voice that stands out that clients like to use, or you've got to have wonderful sets of skills. And I think one of the key things to that in being a really, really good voice actor. It's not only to have an amazing voice, it's actually being able to listen to instructions from the client to be able to deliver that.
And what's your recording setup like?
In the days of COVID, obviously, we've all been isolating and things, and that's when I built my own studio at home and was able to develop that. And now I can work from home, which is fantastic. Before, I'd go off to voice jobs in all these different studios with a Perkins Brailer in a backpack with a guide dog or with a cane before I had my guide dog. And that was pretty confronting, navigating through a busy city, going into a strange building and doing all of that, brailing the job on the way, either through a telephone or reading it manually off a computer because I didn't have an embosser way back then, which is a big braille printer. And so I had to go through a whole pile of steps before I even got into a booth to do a job. You know, there are blind people that use braille displays a lot. Because I've had some spinal damage, I have to push very hard on braille when I read. And therefore, when I use a braille display, what I discovered was the rattling of the pins was too noisy for very high-end sensitive microphones. So I found it easier to use braille in full size. And that therefore means that having a studio here means that I can print it off very quickly. In the old days, before I had my own studio, I'd need sometimes a little bit longer than the average person who normally, when you book a sighted VO, they'll get a call, you've got a booking at such and such a time, they'll go straight into the studio, get handed the script, and off they go. So I needed always a bit of extra time. Now, I don't really at all. I can do it as quickly as a sighted person because all the equipment's here and the embosser's here, so a client can email me a script, book me through, whether it's my agent here or my agent in the US. I print the script off and load up the recording software and I'm off.
And how is your studio different than others you've worked in before?
In terms of the equipment, I've gone fairly high-end. I've got two industry-standard microphones. One is a Neumann U87, which is sort of the gold standard, really, as it were. I've also got a 416 Sennheiser, and that's called a shotgun microphone. So that's used a lot in radio and in promo work. Each of them have got their own preamps. One is an Avalon, which has got tube, so it has a very warm sound, and it's got dials. So again, one of the things I wanted to do in designing the studio was make it very tactile, because a lot of software is quite visual and complex to operate. I looked at using a Mac, and I decided to go to a PC, and so I used Reaper, which is very broadly supported in the blind community. It's got a lot of scripts that are written to function with JAWS. And I had some custom scripting done so that I can use a program called Source Connect. And what Source Connect does is allows me to connect with studios remotely all over the world. It's sort of the mainstream piece of software that most high-end studios use. So I had to have that adapted so that it would work. To my knowledge at this stage, the only blind person that's got Source Connect Pro or Standard working successfully in the world.
You've also said that being blind gives you an advantage as a voiceover artist because your whole world revolves around audio. Can you tell us more about that?
I think in general, having a very good set of ears is crucial because it allows you to, sometimes when you're working with multiple stakeholders doing a job, whether it's an advertising agency and then you've got a copywriter and then you've got the actual client as well, they all have different ideas on what they want. And so sometimes, regardless of whether you've got a good voice or not, you need to be able to interpret what they're all wanting and deliver it. And that can sometimes be quite tricky to do. And so having really good ears means you're listening very carefully to their instructions and also the way they're saying things, which often can give you a little bit more of an insight into exactly what they're really trying to push in this part of the script. So I think it does give me an advantage in that sense.
And you will have had to problem solve and use lateral thinking so much at different points in your life as a blind person, and also the way you engaged with stories as a child was through the magic of other people's narration. So you've been training essentially for your whole life.
That's right. And I think, you know, I've listened to thousands and thousands of hours of audio. Through that, you learn to develop a very acute sense of what works, what doesn't, you know, like a photographer would with taking a picture. It gives you an enormous amount of background to build on. And they're useful skills. You know, getting this studio to work, for example, was quite complicated because whilst there are lots of blind people in the world that use audio equipment, very few of them run studios and voice at the same time. There's a lot of bits and pieces going on when you're reading a job and also running the equipment as well. And that's where lateral thinking helps, because if there was a technical problem with a program, when I had my studio built, the engineer and I went to extraordinary lengths to try and make sure that everything was as easy to use for me as possible, so that when I've got a client on the other end, or if I'm trying to read something, I can reach out and turn a dial and twist a knob. Because the audio interface I use, which is an RME, for example, is very visual and very graphical. So what we've done in this studio is design almost like a custom control unit, which allows me to have knobs and sliders and faders, so I can adjust all my different levels. And I've got pitch level indicators, which people use so that you can hear if your level's too hot or if it's too loud or too soft. It goes beep at different pitches to indicate how hot or cold it is, which is good because you can just reach out and turn a dial. If the client says, oh, that's coming through a bit loud, then you can just pull it back a bit. But that's whereby having it all set up really well means the client never actually needs to ask you to turn it down or to get your audio right in the first place. So you want to make it as easy as possible for people to go, oh, he's great to work with. Oh, and he's blind as a bonus. It shouldn't be about he's blind first and has a great voiceover second. It actually should be about your skill sets. Therefore, you have to be a little bit more organized in how you use equipment as a blind VO.
And how can people get in touch with you?
I've got my own website, which is alistairleevoiceactor.com. Or you can book me through my agent here in Sydney, which is RMK Voice Productions. And I'm also with the Shepherd Agency in the US, wonderful Eric, who runs that group over there. And I'm findable on LinkedIn, which I'm still sort of getting to grips with using. It's not a particularly easy platform, but yeah, they're the ways you can find me. And Google too, you can always Google and find me that way.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Alistair Lee, for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio to talk about your voice acting career.
That's a pleasure, Amelia. It was lovely to have spoken with you.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks to Amelia Hilton and Alistair Lee. And we'll hear from both of them later in the show as they discuss some favourite audiobooks. And talking of which, let's find some new audiobooks in the RNIB Talking Books Library with Lynn Livingston.
First this week, we have a best-selling autobiography, My Name is Barbara by Barbara Streisand, which was gifted to us by Penguin Random House.
One night, my dear friend Andre Barkowiak, a brilliant cinematographer who did two films and a documentary with me, came over for dinner. Actually, he was cooking because I'm a hazard in the kitchen. I can burn water. Andre had been to see his friend earlier, a medical doctor, by the way, and happened to mention that he was having dinner with me. And the doctor said, I hear she's a bitch. What? Said Andre. What are you talking about? He said, she's impossible to work with, I hear. Andre said, that's ridiculous. Have you ever worked with her? No. Well, I have, three times, Andre said. And she's wonderful to work with. In fact, she's a very, very nice person. He says, no, she isn't. She's a bitch. I read it in a magazine. That's the power of the printed word. And there was no hope of changing this man's mind. He chose to believe some writer who had never met me rather than the person who really knows me. That upsets me deeply. Why couldn't he accept the truth?
Barbara Streisand is by any account a living legend, a woman who in a career spanning six decades has excelled in every area of entertainment. She is among the handful of EGOT winners, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar and Tony, and has one of the greatest and most recognisable voices in popular music. She's been nominated for a Grammy 46 times, and with Yentl she became the first woman to write, produce, direct and star in a major motion picture. In My Name is Barbara, she tells her own story about her life and extraordinary career, from growing up in Brooklyn to her first star-making appearances in New York nightclubs to her breakout performance in Funny Girl, musical and film, to the long string of successes in every medium in the years that followed. The book is, like Barbara herself, frank, funny, opinionated, and charming.
For 40 years, publishers have been asking me to write my autobiography, but I kept turning them down because I prefer to live in the present rather than dwell on the past. And the fact is, I'm scared that after 6 decades of people making up stories about me, like the one I just told you, I'm going to tell the truth and nobody's going to believe it. Recently, my husband Jim and I were driving home from a movie and stopped at the supermarket because I suddenly had a craving for coffee ice cream. We walked into the market holding hands, and a man came up behind us and said in a loud voice, "I'm so happy to see you back together." Back together? When were we apart? Did my husband move out and I somehow failed to notice? You see, I like facts. I have great respect for facts. And the idea of just making something up really bothers me. So I finally said yes to writing this book, after dancing around the idea for ages. I actually wrote the first chapter in pencil back in the 1990s. Actually, it was 1999. And then somehow I lost the chapter. I don't know what happened. I'm not very good with typing. I never learned to type. And I couldn't find it. I couldn't find the chapter. But now I wish I knew how to type. Because once I started again, it took another 10 years because I still have other commitments like making records. And besides, I really get bored with myself. I'm trying to recall things that happened a long time ago. Thank God for the journals I've kept, which have been invaluable. And then sometimes I realize that I haven't been remembering the full story and have to dig deeper, no matter where it leads.
My Name is Barbara is written and read by Barbara Streisand and runs for 48 hours and 17 minutes.
We have musician turned actor, now thriller writer, Martin Kemp, with The Game from HarperCollins.
The supersized TV threw kaleidoscopic light around the unlit cavern of a room. Eerie figures leapt across the walls like the shadows of Japanese bunraku puppets. The high ceilings and wooden floor made a perfect echo chamber for the rhythmic thunder exploding from the 2 stacks of Marshall speakers balanced precariously to either side of the aging back projection screen. And now, it's the band you've been waiting for. Here, with their latest smash, it's Klein with Don't Go There. It was a decades-old rerun of Top of the Pops. The bespectacled figure of Mike Reed, everyone's favourite DJ at the time, stood centre screen in Studio 2 of BBC Television Centre in White City. He'd perched on that flimsy metal bridge, flickering with multicoloured lights as it hung over what was possibly the most famous stage in Britain. The raised platform on which hundreds of major league pop and rock stars from the UK and beyond had performed alongside equal numbers of wannabes, whose dreams and ambitions would ultimately never survive the dog-eat-dog cruelty of the music business, 80s payola, and the hunting packs of managers and agents always so keen to pull you apart and fit you back together, Frankenstein-like, in their own frustrated pop star image.
Johnny Klein is a rock casualty, a fallen 1980s pop star who's lost everything, his family, his money, and his fame. Thrown a lifeline by an old contact in the music business, Johnny doesn't care what he's getting himself into. Dragged down into East London's dark underbelly, Johnny discovers there's more at stake than his own shattered ego. Johnny hates being yesterday's man, but now he's wishing he could disappear altogether. The party might be over, but there's no escape from the past.
Guitar chords boomed, and a sequencer kicked in, creating that perfect synth sound of the 80s. A classy combo of Trevor Horn's ABC and the jangly guitar cool of Lenny Kravitz. The mesmerising figure of Johnny Klein sauntered to the mic, the cameras closing in, manoeuvring sensually around him. As he struck pure magic from his Gibson Goldtop, the sea of girls moving to the front rhythmically like a shockwave from a tsunami. He was an instantly eye-catching figure, clad in a pristine white Catherine Hamnett parachute shirt, a bullet belt from Camden Market slung low on his narrow waist and a pair of shiny leather jeans, which fell perfectly onto his black studded seditionary's boots, an ensemble that harked straight back to teenage days spent hanging out on the King's Road, outside Malcolm and Vivian's uber-famous punk landmark shop, Sex, with its giant, backwards-spinning clock. All of that energy and rebellion was written deep into his trim, well-muscled form, and pale, insolent features, not to mention those piercing blue eyes under that sharp, jet-black fringe. His looks were angelic, someone in the music press had written, but not quite, because there's something devilish there too. The teenage girls of the nation would be swooning already, even though Johnny hadn't sung a word yet. With a flamboyant flourish, he launched himself into a song familiar throughout the land. It wasn't just a hit with every radio station. You couldn't stand in a queue without hearing the person next to you humming it, couldn't walk through a supermarket or stand in a lift, or even wander the streets of your town without Johnny's voice caressing you from some open car window. A voice that wasn't great, by his own admission, but which was easily good enough for rock and roll. Christ! The man in front of the giant-sized screen grunted to himself. He was slumped in a bulging black leather lazy boy, his bleary eyes locked on these visions of the distant past, as he took another long, tired drag on his Marlborough.
The Game by Martin Kemp is read by Paul Thorley with Martin Kemp and runs for 11 hours 16 minutes.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book service and studios. Back in the days of recording to tape, sometimes the narrators were asked to go a little bit faster.
We looked at the tape, we looked at the book, we looked at the amount of tape we had, and there's a chapter heading coming up in a page and a half's time. You've got 3 minutes. Can you speed up a little bit? We're not going, it wasn't quite that bad, but we did tend to try and speed up a little bit.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Keith Brimmer-Jones from the Great Pottery Throwdown is currently on tour. I spoke to him about his book, Boy in a China Shop, at the Boswell Book Festival. Keith Brimmer-Jones is the star presenter and judge of Channel 4's The Great Pottery Throwdown. Famous for his emotional responses to the heartfelt and personal pieces made by the contestants on the show. In Boy in a China Shop, his first ever memoir, Keith tells the story of his life and inspiring rise to success through the objects and images that have been meaningful to him every step of the way. And despite having severe dyslexia, Keith read the audiobook.
This was how I kept myself sane during the first COVID-19 lockdown in 2020. Doing what I love most. Of course, for the first few days, my partner Marge and I didn't know what to do with ourselves. We had no reference points. We had never seen shops, pubs and restaurants shut down en masse before, and no one had ever forbidden us to see our friends and family, or anyone else for that matter. It was unnerving, but after those first tense days, I stopped stressing about work and then stopped stressing about everything. I was first approached by Hodder to do my biography, which I was very flattered by, and I'm not much of a writer, obviously, I'm a potter, and they suggested getting me a ghostwriter in to do it. And actually, I suggested that my eldest friend,
who is actually a writer, write the book with me. And so that's what happened. So Mick James, who's I've known since teenagers, he helped me write the book, and we wrote it together, and it was fascinating. And we came up with this concept of each chapter really starts with either a person or an object that was quite significant in that in that point of my life. And we weave the story, slightly technical story, and the history of said object or person into the chapter of about my life. And it really it's a book about the algorithm of life, basically, how you make a decision, and as random as it may be, the universe just provides you with a different path. And it's amazing. Yeah.
How did the universe provide you with clay?
The universe provided me with clay through an art teacher called Mr. Mortman. You know, we all remember an inspirational teacher at school. It's amazing. And mine was Mr. Mortman at school, secondary school, gave me my first lump of clay, as he did with all the other people in my class. Half of them started doing a clay fight, and the other half, which I was in the latter of, we started actually making something. So and the moment I touched the clay, it was just an amazing experience. I knew then I was going to be a potter. It's just such an malleable, tactile material that the way I describe it is, it's basically your the potential of your imagination on a bench. And at the time, I didn't realise at the time, but the importance of me being dyslexic, of which I am, it's the perfect medium for someone who's dyslexic, because someone who has dyslexia has a much better affinity with shape, form and volume. Quite a lot of architects are severely... Norman Foster, severely dyslexic. It obviously tapped into that part of my brain, and it was just perfect. Yeah, loved it.
It's an extremely tactile, sensual experience, and I don't mind admitting that I'm addicted to it. The connection is so profound. It's like the clay is an extension of me. It's all over in a flash. I think that's another integral part of the process that I find so appealing. It has to be done at speed, in one continuous movement. There's no time to stop and think about it. It is 2 or 3 minutes of total concentration. The best part is when I've finished, I can pick up another lump of clay and do it again and again.
Now, talking of dyslexia, you narrated the audiobook.
Yes.
How was that?
It was good. Yeah, it was eventful. It was good. But it was a bit of a challenge. But it's amazing what they can do with modern technology these days. And it was really good. And I'm glad I did it. It was over 3 days. And it was wonderful. And apparently, the engineer told me I wasn't the worst. So that helped. It was a great experience. Yeah, I had a lot of banter with the engineer. He was a lovely chap. We recorded it down in Soho in London. And it was great because it was an old haunt of mine when I was in the band days. And so it was great having to go to work there for 3 days. So it was brilliant. Yeah, loved it. I'm always, you know, when you do anything creative, you're always faced with challenges every day. It's always good to try and overcome them. It gives you greater confidence. And one of the biggest sayings in my life that I sort of live by is, a pessimist's problem is an optimist's opportunity. And I love that saying because you can turn things around to your advantage, no matter how bad they are.
So I settled into a nice little routine. I'd get up an hour or two after my usual waking hour, enjoy a leisurely breakfast, something previously totally unknown to me, and then sit down at my wheel to centre some clay and make something just for the hell of it.
Boy in a China Shop, written and read by Keith Brimmer-Jones, is available commercially now.
And since that recording, Boy in a China Shop is now also available in the RNIB Talking Books Library, where it joins...
We have the new novel by award-winning writer John Boyne. It's called Water and was given to us by Penguin Random House.
The first thing I do when I arrive on the island is change my name. I've been Vanessa Carvin for a long time, 28 years. But I was Vanessa Hale for 24 years before that, and there's an unexpected comfort in reclaiming my birthright, which sometimes feels as if it was stolen from me, even though I was complicit in the crime. A few minutes later, I change it again, this time to Willow Hale. Willow is my middle name, and it seems prudent to take a further step in separating the woman I am now from the woman I once was, lest anyone here makes the connection. My parents were unremarkable, middle-class people, a teacher and a shop assistant. And there were some who thought them presumptuous in calling their daughter Vanessa Willow, which summons images of a Bloomsbury writer or a painter's wan muse. But I was always rather pleased with it. I had notions about myself back then, I suppose. I don't have them any longer.
The first thing Vanessa Carvin does when she arrives on the island is change her name. To the locals, she is Willow Hale, a solitary outsider escaping Dublin to live a hermetic existence in a small cottage, not a notorious woman on the run from her past. But scandals follow like hunting dogs. She has some questions of her own to answer. If her ex-husband really is the monster everyone says he is, then how complicit was she in his crimes? Escaping her old life might seem like a good idea, but the choices she has made throughout her marriage have consequences. Here, on the island, Vanessa must reflect on what she did and did not do. Only then can she discover whether she is worthy of finding peace at all.
My next task is to shave my head. I've kept my hair shoulder length and blonde for as long as I can remember, but I purchased an electric razor before leaving Dublin and plugged the device in to charge for half an hour before easing it around my skull, experiencing a feverish delight in watching the clumps tumble into the sink or fall on the floor around my feet. Standing in the cascading tendrils of my femininity, I decide not to make myself entirely bald, for that would draw too much attention, and I don't have the head for it anyway, unlike the famous singer who looked like one of God's angels when she first appeared on our television screens. Instead, I shear myself down to the uncomplicated blunt crop of a hard-working country woman, someone far too busy to concern herself with indulging the physical. The blonde is gone now, replaced by a darkish grey that must have been lurking inside me all the time, like a benign cancer. I wonder how I will look when it starts to grow out again, and rather hope that it won't. The truth is, it would be more convenient if it just gave up the ghost with the cruel efficiency it inflicts on men. I explore the cottage and find it suitable to my needs. The photographs I saw online did not lie about its austerity. The front door opens onto a living room that houses a kitchen, or perhaps a kitchen that houses a living room. There's a single bedroom with a single bed. How strange it will feel to sleep like a child again. And a small bathroom with no shower. An unappealing rubber attachment is squeezed plumply around the tap spouts, and I pull it away, relocating it to a cupboard beneath the sink. The roof must be sound, for there are no damp spots on the stone floor that have fallen from above. The simplicity, the monastic nature of all of this pleases me. It is so far from what I am accustomed to.
Water by John Boyne is read by Niamh Cusack and runs for 4 hours and 38 minutes.
For cricket lovers, HarperCollins have given us The Tourist, What Goes on Tour Has Always Stayed on Tour by Phil Tufnell.
For someone known for his love of sleeping, I've spent far too much time on my feet, most of it on the cricket pitch, a lesser but still sizeable percentage stood at the bar afterwards, and a small but nevertheless significant amount running away from Graham Gooch. Then there was my run-up. OK, rarely was I mistaken for Dennis Lilly, But doing that little hop, skip and a jump a few hundred times a day is bound to lead to wear and tear. After a long day in the field, next morning I could barely move. I was one of the few players to carry a can of WD-40 in his holdall. Remember as well I did strictly, and pointing your feet one way while going another is never going to be good for your skeleton. Gorka Marquez and Giovanni Panici might look good now, but come their 50s, they'll be hobbling down the promenade at Southend like the rest of us. I tell you, the minute I was eliminated, I parked up my American smooth forever. And yet it's Dawn who's stuck in bed recuperating while I play nursemaid. I've got legs like Chris Hoy. I've been up and down the stairs so many times. I've also acquired a real empathy for Carson in Downton Abbey. I've had a few injuries in my time, but never did I think I'd get housemaid's knee.
As a cricketer, broadcaster and celebrity jungle dweller, Phil Tufnell has travelled the world far and wide. From the great cricket tours of Australia and South Africa, to his equally memorable jaunts to Benidorm and Blackpool, Phil has spent much of his life living out of a suitcase, meeting a host of colourful and memorable characters along the way. The Tourist takes you out on the road, into the dressing room and behind the scenes of the commentary box to reveal just what really happens on tour. Did Phil once push a baby grand piano down the stairs of a plush hotel? Did he accidentally eat a rat? Was he blamed for England being bowled out for 46 against the West Indies without even being in the team? There's only one way to find out. It's time to take a hilarious trip across the world with one of our most treasured sports personalities.
That's without the burns up my forearms from ironing and shoving shepherd's pies in the oven. I'm like a tiger, a series of dark stripes where I keep catching myself on the grill. The way I look at it, your house is where you relax. You go out, do whatever it is you're doing that day, come home, empty the cat tray, do a bit of cooking, and have a sit on a nice plump settee for a few hours. Now I've reached the point where if I manage a sit down with a cup of tea and a biscuit and catch 10 minutes of bargain hunt, I'm happy. I actually look forward to bangers and cash. I sit there with a bourbon in one hand and a tub of cold cream for my litany of wounds in the other. Last week, I got 3 countdown conundrums in a row. If there was to be a documentary made about these few weeks, it would be called Hip Operation, The Aftermath. Tragic scenes would unfold of a bloke wandering round his house with a little bottle of beer in one hand and a feather duster in the other. Like a dog on a chain, I can only get so far. While dogs can't get past the front door to bite the postman without the chain tightening, I can't get beyond the airing cupboard. I have fevered dreams of donning my wife's lycra and escaping to the village hall for half an hour of keep fit. More than once I've thought about scrawling, "Help me!" in the condensation on the front window.
The Tourist. What goes on tour has always stayed on tour until now, by Phil Tufnell, is read by Rupert Farley and runs for 8 hours 58 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Thanks, Lynn. At the end of today's show, we'll return to Keith Brimmer-Jones for the books of his life. But now, a return to Australia's only blind voiceover artist, Alistair Lee, talking to Amelia Hilton.
I'm here with Australia's only blind voice actor, Alistair Lee, to get a peek behind the scenes of recording audiobooks and discuss some of his favourite audiobook narrators. Hi, Alistair. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Amelia. It's lovely to talk to you.
So you grew up listening to and loving lots of different audiobooks, but you haven't recorded that many now that you're a professional voice actor because of the cost. Can you tell us a bit more about that and which elements are expensive?
Because I've sustained some nerve damage, I've got cerebral palsy and arthritis. So one of the problems when we were building my recording studio originally, braille displays are a single line of braille which changes you read electronically. And because I've got very high-end microphones here, we found that they were always picking up a slight rattle because I need to push my fingers down quite hard to read. And on braille, full-size braille sheets, that's not so much of a problem because they can be made to be quieter, whereas the pins would rattle on braille displays. And so the issue I have is braille paper is very expensive because I do single-sided, not double-sided braille. If I was to print out, say, a 300 or 400-page book, that would be 1,000 pages. So the cost of, you know, that, when you add that up in terms of dollars and cents, chews into, you know, the amount you're paid to narrate a book quite significantly. So that's been one of my hesitations. I'm not giving up on the idea because I would love to narrate audiobooks because I've listened to so many, and accents are my world and what I love doing. Maybe I'll start with children's books first that are shorter form and easier and less expensive to transcribe, and then I can move into long form books. But it is a dream of mine one day to be able to do it, because I come at it with years of experience as a listener, but also understanding how to edit and produce as well myself. I can do some of that production to make it easier for a post-production engineer or, you know, another studio to work with me as well. I don't give up easily, so we'll see how we go in the next few years.
And there are a few narrators whose work you admire and that you're in touch with who feature in the RNIB Talking Books Library, who we'll discuss today. And we're going to start by listening to David Rintel as he reads Winged Escort by Douglas Riemann.
Lieutenant Tim Rowan stood on the side of Gladstone Dock and studied the overhanging bulk of the aircraft carrier with something like apprehension. Behind and around him, the air was filled with all the usual noises, creaking gantries, a clatter of dockside machinery, and the sloshing footsteps of workers and sailors alike as they bustled through a steady drizzle. It was mid-July 1943, but this was Liverpool, where it always seemed to rain a great deal, and where war had left too deep a mark for people to think much of past summers.
David, I think, has a beautifully modulated voice, and also being an actor of such extraordinary calibre, he reads very passionately. So, and it's interesting, his native accent obviously is Scottish, but he will change it to be anglicised for certain different types of reads, but you can still hear this slight little bit of Scot coming through. And his phrasing is just so unique. He is a true magician.
When they reached the starboard walkway, the change in the sky was very apparent. More cloud at several levels, and only occasional patches of sky still visible. The ships were in firm formation, shining dully in the grey light, and aboard the nearest sloop, Bill could see the duffel-coated seamen at work with tackles and hoists, taking up extra magazines and clips of shells for the short-range anti-aircraft guns. It was funny how you never thought of the things you'd achieved, the dangers you'd avoided, but only of the next one ahead, and the one after that. Growler's tannoy boomed, "All anti-aircraft weapon crews will exercise in half an hour." As an afterthought, the quartermaster added, "Senior hands have messes to muster for rum." Van Rooyen rubbed his hands. "The British! I wonder you did not issue the rum first."
A lot of the modern audiobooks these days are read by, you know, audiobook narrators, where they don't have the acting skills, I think, that some of the, what I'd call old-school narrators have that have been doing it for a very long time, you know, from the 70s, 80s, 90s and today. And I think David's emotion comes through so clearly, whether it's descripting, whether it's heightened sense of an action scene, or whether it's something that's very sad. He has the most beautifully articulate way of putting words into your head via headphones. I was very privileged to be able to contact David, a mutual friend of ours. I was able to obtain contact details for David, and I wrote to David to thank him for the hours of pleasure that he provided, but also for inspiring me to become a voice actor.
Next up is Sean Barrett, and here he is reading The Devil's Star by Joe Nesbo from the Harry Hole series.
Harry hated theme pubs, Irish pubs, topless pubs, novelty pubs, or, worst of all, celebrity pubs, where the walls were lined with portraits of regular customers of some notoriety. The theme of underwater was a vaguely nautical mix of diving and the romanticism of old wooden ships. But at some point, well into his fourth beer, Harry couldn't care less about gurgling aquariums of green water, diving helmets, and the rustic interiors of creaking wood. It could have been worse. The last time he had been here, people had suddenly burst into a round of operatic favourites. For a moment he had the feeling that the musical had finally caught up with reality. He took stock and confirmed with some relief that none of the four guests in the pub looked as though they were considering breaking into song for the time being.
He has this gravitas about him. He has a whimsical side as well. I think when you've narrated as much as he has, both for television and for audiobooks, he plays the vulnerable very well. He has an extraordinary breadth to do with accents and characters. His depth of skill just shines through in how he reads. It's utterly extraordinary.
A train passed like a long, gentle breath of air. Ullag opened her eyes and discovered that she was standing in the garden. Odd. She couldn't remember leaving the house. But there she was, standing between the railway lines, with the smell of roses and lilacs in her nostrils. The pressure on her temples had not eased, quite the contrary. She looked up. It had clouded over. That was why it was so dark. Ullag looked down at her bare feet. White skin, blue veins, the feet of an old lady. She knew why she was standing on this exact spot. They had stood here, Ernst and Randy.
Next, we'll talk about Jeff Harding, and here he is reading Every Dead Thing by John Connolly from the Charlie Parker series.
It is cold in the car, cold as the grave. I prefer to leave the AC on full, to let the falling temperature keep me alert. The volume on the radio is low, but I can still hear a tune, vaguely insistent over the sound of the engine. It's early REM, something about shoulders and rain. I've left Cornwall Bridge about 8 miles behind, and soon I'll be entering South Canaan, then Canaan itself, before crossing the state line into Massachusetts. Ahead of me, the bright sun is fading as day bleeds slowly into night.
I came across Jeff Harding through the Jack Reacher series, as I love thrillers and detective books and sort of action books. And I thought to myself, my goodness me, you know, he's a slightly younger Jack Nicholson. That was what I first thought when I heard him. And then, you know, I just fell in love with his skill, particularly in reading female characters. Jeff has an amazing way of being able to do that, because he's got quite a gruff, strong bottom end, and his delivery, it can be silken smooth, but it also has this wonderful hard-edged sort of undertone to it. But he can soften it to do female characters brilliantly well, which is not always feasible for a lot of men to be able to do.
2 weeks is a long time in a murder case. After 2 weeks with no progress, unless you get very, very lucky, the investigation starts to grind to a halt.
This seems to indicate a killer of above-average intelligence, one who likes playing games and gambling, said Wolf. The fact that he appeared to want the element of shock to play a part could lead us to conclude that there was a personal element to what he did, directed against the husband. But that's just speculation, and the general pattern of this type of crime is impersonal.
I've been able to correspond with Jeff as well, which for me has just been such a privilege. Jeff, who I've looked up to and listened to as a voice actor in narration for a long time, to be able to communicate with him and share again my admiration for what he's done, it's just been so very special.
And finally, here's Garrick Hagan reading Cross by James Patterson from the Alex Cross series.
Everything about the night is so very clear to me. Still is, after all this time, all these years that have passed, everything that's happened. The horrible murders, the homicides solved, and sometimes not. I stood in the darkened bedroom with my arms lightly circling my wife Maria's waist, my chin resting on her shoulder. I was 31 then, and had never been happier at any time of my life. Nothing even came close to what we had together. Maria, Damon, Janny, and me. It was the fall of 1993, a million years ago, it seems to me now. It was also past 2 in the morning, and our baby Janny had the croup something terrible. Poor sweet girl had been up for most of the night, most of the last few nights, most of her young life.
Garrick has a style all of his own. I think, you know, there are lots of people with deep voices, there are lots of people with unusual voices. Garrick has, you know, obviously been Canadian in background and having lived in England for many, many decades, and, you know, Garrick knows production so well as well. He just has the most extraordinary way of delivering. His intonation is quite unique, and some of his phrasing and delivery, it is just Garrick. You know when you hear it that that is Garrick Hagan.
Marianne was thinking that she really didn't want to resist this cute guy from New York City. Besides, she was safe inside the bar on M Street. What could go wrong in here? What could anybody try to pull? Play a New Kids on the Block tune on the jukebox? I don't much like the spotlight, he was saying, leading her toward the back of the bar. You think you're another Tom Cruise, don't you? Does that big smile of yours always work? Get you what you want? She asked. She was smiling too, though, daring him to bring his best moves. I don't know, M.M. Sometimes it works okay, I guess. Then he kissed her in the semi-darkened hallway at the back of the bar, and the kiss was as good as Marianne could have hoped. Kind of sweet, actually. Definitely more on the romantic side than she'd expected. He didn't even try to cop a feel along with the kiss, which might have been all right with her. But this was better.
And I've also had the pleasure of communicating with Garrick, too, which has just been such a lovely thing to be able to do, to thank these wonderful, wonderful people who have inspired my voice journey.
And if you do start narrating audiobooks, what would be the first book on your list that you'd absolutely love to perform?
I have absolutely no idea, Amelia. I think we just have to wait and see.
Well, thank you so much, Alistair Lee, for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Amelia, it's been lovely talking with you. Thank you so much.
You can find all of the books mentioned in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's Read On, a return to Keith Brimmer-Jones for the books of his life.
Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an avid reader because of the aforementioned, really. But one book that really, really struck me, and quite frankly, it was probably the illustrations in the book at first, but it was the whole story of Robinson Crusoe and how he found himself on an island and he had to make do and mend and create a home for himself. And I've kind of got this lovely romantic idea of just living in the mountains with a penknife and nothing else and just staying there, really. That really tapped into my imagination. Yeah, loved it.
I soon found the place I was in was not for my settlement, particularly because it was upon a low, moorish ground near the sea, and I believed would not be wholesome, and more particularly because there was no fresh water near it. So I resolved to find a more healthy and more convenient spot of ground. I consulted several things in my situation which I found would be proper for me. First, health and fresh water, I just now mentioned. Secondly, shelter from the heat of the sun. Thirdly, security from ravenous creatures, whether man or beast. Fourthly, a view to the sea, that if God sent any ship in sight, I might not lose any advantage for my deliverance, of which I was not willing to banish all my expectation yet.
The RNIB version of Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe is read by Stephen Thorne.
And this may come back to pottery, but what sort of books do you go back to on a rainy day to reread?
The story of Lucy Rhee. Lucy Rhee is a famous contemporary sort of potter, and she really inspired me when I was young. And she still inspires me now. She's sadly died, but I'm constantly reading books on Lucy Rhee. Love her, yeah, absolutely.
I'm
Unfortunately, Lucy Rhee, Modernist Potter by Emmanuel Cooper, is only available in audio by using text to speech.
Is there a book that you'd recommend reading just now?
Well, funnily enough, being in a studio, Radio 4 was amazing. Because I'm working with Clay and I can listen to the radio without any kind of interruptions. And for me, Nothing But the Truth by The Secret Barrister was an audio book, a book of the week on Radio 4. And it was so wonderful. I actually bought the audio book and I'm listening to it now in my studio. So it's wonderful, yeah.
It wasn't how you're making it sound, yeah?
The joy.
I hear a stifled snort from the Crown Prosecution Service paralegal sitting on the row in front of me. My cross-examination, as written out neatly in the standard-issue blue counsel's notebook perched on my lectern, was going to end on that last over-gestated question. But now, not only is Mr. Tuttle giving the jury an implausible story, he's trying to wriggle out of it. The one thing worse than a liar is a liar lying about being a liar. So I treat myself to an encore. It wasn't how I made it sound. Nah. Well, we know Mr. Martins is blind, yes?
Yes.
And you agree he was on crutches?
Yes.
And you say that he hit you first?
Yeah.
Right, so let's try again. You're saying that the blind man on crutches hit you first, aren't you?
Yeah.
Right.
A clip from The Secret Barrister, Stories of the Law and How It's Broken. Three books, Nothing But the Truth, The Secret Barrister and Fake Law, The Truth About Justice in an Age of Lies, are all available commercially and all are narrated by Jack Hawkins. And a reminder that Boy in a China Shop, Life, Clay and Everything by Keith Brimmer-Jones is available in audio from RNIB Library. That's all we've got time for on today's show. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, there are over 350 episodes in our podcast feed. Just type Read On, RNIB, into your favourite podcast app.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.